Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is musician Stevie Black, who plays all things strings. First of all, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the music world has changed a whole lot in this last year. How so? Well, music streaming finally is mainstream. We finally hit 100 million subscribers, and this is a milestone. This is the number that everybody said, once we hit 100 million, the music business will be healthy again. Is it healthy? Well, more so than it has been in the last 10 years or so. Everything is getting better in the music business, but it doesn't necessarily mean that things are great. That being said, this was the first year in which the record labels, and these are both indies and major labels, made most of their money from streaming rather than anything else. So in other words, streaming made them more money than downloads or physical product, and this is the first year that's really happened. If we look at the 100 million subscribers, it's a pretty interesting market share map. First of all, Spotify has about 43 million paid subscribers. Apple Music, about half that, 21. Deezer, which not a lot of people know about, but it's very big in Europe, and they just launched in North America this past year. Deezer has 7 million. Napster, believe it or not, there's that name again, 4.5 million. Tidal, only 1 million, although, depending on the assumptions that you hear by most analysts, it's anywhere between 2 and 3 million, but this is 1 million that we know they have. And all of the other services amount to 21.4. If I were to look at one particular company this coming year, I'd look at Amazon, because Amazon has as deep a pockets as anybody else, and that's where the big growth is going to come from. That being said, streaming has been growing at roughly the same rate for the last 18 months. It's growing at a good pace, but not a great pace. So everyone is looking at this and saying, okay, now we've hit 100 million, now what? Many analysts think that there's actually a ceiling here, and the ceiling is because of the $9.99 a month price. It's not going to grow at a really rapid pace until that comes down. And of course, the $4.99 area is where everyone thinks that it's really going to explode at. But so far, we haven't seen that happen. And it'll make for an interesting year. But streaming is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. So we have to all get used to it. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new music producer formula course, as well as my other online video courses at BobbyOsinskiCourses, all one word, .com. For more on my music industry and music production blogs, just go to BobbyOsinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, chances are that you have a deep love of music and you've always had it. But can you imagine there are some people that music is not a part of their lives? They don't own any, they don't know any, and it's just not something that they like or consider. Believe it or not, 3 to 5% of the population feels that way, and it's something called anhedonia. It's a real medical condition. Basically, what they found in a couple of studies, McGill University and University of Barcelona, found out that there's reduced connectivity in the hemispheres of the brain. That's what causes this. That being said, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with people that don't like music. They're otherwise very happy and very healthy. They just don't like music. It's not they don't like it, it's just not a part of their lives. They don't much care about it. Now, that being said, there's a lot of study being made in this area because researchers say that if they can figure out why this is happening, it might actually lead to a treatment for apathy and depression and addiction. So it's interesting how music in so many different ways is applied to our health or lack of. It's always been that way. Music is a sign of how we're feeling. What we listen to really has a bearing on how we feel, and vice versa. Music is really a part of us. And if it isn't, if you're one of the 5% of the population that has anhedonia, I feel sorry for you, but you're probably not listening to this anyway. Stevie Black is a multi-instrumentalist known as the String Guy because he records full string sections of violin, viola, cello, and double bass all by himself. He also does sessions on mandolin, dobro, and sitar, and virtually anything else that has a string on it. Stevie has played or recorded with a wide variety of music superstars, including Beck, Pink, Madonna, Snoop Dogg, Ludacris, Gary Clark Jr., Rihanna, Colby Calais, and many, many more. I spoke with Stevie via Skype from his studio in Los Angeles. I read your bio, and you had a very interesting path that got you to the violin.
That's true, yeah.
So how did it happen where you went from guitar to mandolin to violin? Because that seems very unusual, to say the least.
Well, it's a little backwards. I started on guitar because, you know, I was going to be a singer-songwriter, and that's the way I thought it was going to be, you know.
Yeah.
And then I fell in love with the music of David Grisman and went out and got a mandolin. And then within a year, I did that while I was at Berkeley. So after my second year, I had the opportunity to actually move to California and study with David. So I took that opportunity, went out to the Bay Area and, learned from him for a bit. And then when I realized after a couple of years, I decided I'd go back to Berkeley and wanted to continue my mandolin, but the school didn't really recognize mandolin as an instrument at the time. So Matt Glazier had just recorded an album with David. So I talked to Matt and I was like, you know, I want to continue with this and all that. So he decided that we could do mandolin, but I'd have to play violin as well. So it was really his doing that made me pick up the violin at all.
So that means you started relatively late as compared to most violin players.
I didn't pick up the violin until I was 21.
Okay. What was that like then?
It was definitely a big learning curve. Like I knew I had the left hand pretty much down because of the mandolin. So it was really all about learning the bow. So the first year it was all kind of working on my bow chops exactly, you know, to figure out how to get tone out of the instrument.
But then you took to it fairly well then, right?
It took some time, but yeah, you know, and when I learned the mandolin, I put down the guitar for a year. So when I picked up the violin, I put down everything else for the most part. I mean, I was still doing mandolin, but, you know, I really concentrated and studied hard and, you know, didn't see a lot of people during that time.
Was there a point where you decided that I can make more money as a violin player than as a mandolin player or guitar player? Or how did that happen? I mean, because none of them are easy to make money with, but I'm just curious what the path is.
Well, it's a little easier to make a living if you play them all than, than any one of them. It gives you a little more versatility. So after college, I ended up moving back to the Bay Area, and David's son introduced me to Dan Hicks. And I ended up touring with Dan for 6 years or so, playing mandolin and violin and sometimes even guitar. So, and then I hooked up with Vince Welnick from the Grateful Dead and a couple of other people and, you know, was touring and doing a lot of that throughout the 90s, you know, in my 20s. So when I moved to LA, I figured I wanted to do more studio work and try not to tour as much and started getting these calls to go to hip hop sessions actually through Mike Elizondo was the first one to hook me up with that. Which I saw you had just interviewed him.
Yeah.
Mike's great. So, he gave me a call to come in and do some hip hop sessions. This was before he did the Eminem thing, you know, before he became huge. So I started doing all these sessions for like Snoop and Ice Cube and whoever, you know, everyone else that was doing it at the time. And mostly it was just learning violin and kind of learning how to arrange on the fly, you know, coming up with parts. And then they'd track it all on tape and bounce it down to their MPC and, you know, be able to fly it around with that.
But it was just you though. It wasn't an ensemble. It was just you.
It was kind of improvising on the fly and then harmonizing to that and, you know, coming up with different parts, but it was all, you know, never more than for the hip hop stuff. It's never more than like an 8-bar section. So it's kind of short and quick and easy.
But it sounds like that sort of set the trend then for you, because that's what you do now. Mostly you just do everything yourself rather than with other players. Yeah. Am I
So I was learning how to arrange on the fly, and I was learning, you know, it was just violin at the time. And then one day they were like, can you play lower, tune it down, you know, something. So I went out, rented a cello, and the next day came back to the studio and was playing it on the song, you know, just low fat notes, basically. And that kind of, like, after I got that, again, I really delved into that instrument and learned how to play that. And then eventually just got a double bass and a viola as well.
Wow. What was the learning curve like then? It must have been easier since you already knew the violin and kind of had an idea of that. You know, how long did it really take until you felt proficient?
Well, within 2 years, I was playing it on TV with Minnie Driver, of all people. We did the Tavis Smiley show.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, at that point, I felt comfortable enough to, you know, not embarrass myself or them, you know. So.
Okay. So when you get called then, you just get called by yourself to come in and lay down a section, essentially, right?
Yeah. And it's not even come in. It's usually we'll send you something or we'll come over, because I have pretty much the setup at my studio here where everything's there and ready to go for the most part. So usually, more often than not, people send me the songs and or come over with sessions, or I'll meet them in the studio and then bring it home. That's usually how it works.
Is your studio, since it's built especially for you and what you do, is it different than other studios? How have you approached it?
I like a little more room noise, room sound, more of a reverberation in the room, natural room, I guess. So, you know, I built this whole wall of, you know, wood planks to keep it. Diffusers, yeah, but also reverberate. The drum corner has a different texture, but also, you know, more reflective. And the ceiling too is, you know, has a bunch of stuff. When I built this place, I tore off the ceiling of the original garage and made it a little taller. And, you know, just did as much as I could in a small space and with the money that I had to build it.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is all the instruments. When you play a note, all the guitars and all the other string instruments, as well as the piano, just reflect that note. So, you know, you get the natural instruments humming from each note you play.
Oh, I see. Like a resonance then.
Yeah, very, very resonant. So, you know, when I'm playing the violin, I might play, you know, end my notes, but the resonance will keep it going for a bit because all the other instruments.
That's unique, but it makes perfect sense. But it's something that you never hear about.
Yeah. And a lot of people try to stop that because they don't want that resonance going on with different things. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that aside, tell me something that engineers don't know about recording strings. What do you run into?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I've learned some tricks over the years through, you know, obviously some great producers like Steve Lillywhite and other people like that. Matt Cerletic, you know, mm-hmm. have taught me like certain things. So kind of put it all together. When I'm recording my sections, I prefer to use a stereo mic in the middle of the room and then a close mic, usually a U47 up close, which is a Nigel Godrich thing. He likes everything as close as you can get to the instrument, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, whoever I send the tracks to will have the option of getting that up close, gritty kind of sound, or more of a room, you know, far away sound. So I do that for each track, even if it's like a 40 piece orchestra that I'm recording. And then I will mix those down to, you know, a stereo stem of close mics for each instrument, a stereo stem of room mics for each instrument. I avoid the phase. In some ways, it works better for me because I'm not a classical player. I don't have the same vibrato on every take. I don't use the same instrument. I have like five different violins, two violas, two cellos, you know, so it's not the exact same instrument, and I'm not playing things the same way when I overdub myself.
When you do that, then, what is the typical number of parts that you put on?
I mean, there's no typical. It really depends on the song and what's needed, you know, if it's more of an acoustic kind of, you know, guitar vocal song, I'll just do a quartet. If it's if the song has a lot going on and I need feel I need to cut through more, I'll do anything from a 10 piece to, like I said, up to a 40 piece section, which is me recording it 40 times.
How long does that take you?
I could do it in a day. You know, I used to do all the music for The Voice Australia. and they would send me 3 or 4 songs on Monday. And I would have to do the arrangement and send back a 25 piece orchestra by Wednesday night. So that would be that was a long couple of days. But
do you always do your own arrangements, or do you get arrangements from other people?
That's a mixture. I mean, more often than not, I do it. But some people, like I've worked, like I said, Matt Serletic, I've worked with a lot. Always did his own arrangements, and occasionally I'll add little flares or flourishes or change a note or two if I feel it's not working. But you know, he's a great arranger, so he always did his own. And other people have their own ideas. Sometimes I'll just get like a main melody and say to, you know, kind of arrange around that. Mm-hmm. Well, like Timberland, who I've worked with a bunch, would just send me a song and say, do something with this. Yeah.
Good for you. That's easy that way. Well, I get, maybe not.
The first thing I ever did for Tim was he sent me a track. It was just him on beats, Elton John on piano. And he said, do something with this. I'm like, holy crap, that's Elton John.
Yeah, right.
What do I do with that? How do I make this something?
Okay, when you're building a section then, where do you start from? Is there a typical place?
It's all about the song. Not coming from, like I said, a classical background. I'm coming more from a singer-songwriter background. I really kind of have a better understanding, comprehension of how songs are built in some ways, I think, than like a classical orchestrator might.
So you're never starting with the violin then, for instance?
Not always, no. I mean, sometimes I'll hear, you know, more of a main melody where I'll start with that. Sometimes it's more of like a rhythmic, percussive kind of string sound that will fit in the song. It really depends. There's no one way to do it, and I don't do it any one way.
How about via genre? You do a lot for hip hop artists. Is the approach different for that genre than it might be for a singer songwriter?
Not necessarily. I mean, again, it's about the song. It's about what's missing, what's needed, what I can do to enhance it and make, you know, my goal. I learned this touring with Dan Hicks, was always kind of do your thing but don't get noticed until it's time to be noticed, you know? So I kind of take that in my arrangement approach as well. So it's like, I don't want to step on any vocals. I don't want to step on any other instruments until it's time to, like, okay, this is my section. This is where I'm going to shine, you know, and then I'll wail it.
Yeah. Wow. Do you play live anymore?
Every once in a while. Yeah. I just did the American Music Awards with Shawn Mendes a couple weeks ago, or a month ago now, I guess. Time's just flying, right?
When you go out live then, do you use a built-in mic on the instrument, or how does that usually work?
More often than not, I have a 5-string violin that I have a pickup, you know, an LR Bags put on it. I've got a cello with a Bags pickup also. So usually I'll use that. If the situation calls for like more of an orchestral kind of sound and they have enough inputs and all, we'll put little clip-on mics on all the strings.
Yeah, I could use a lot of inputs for that, I can imagine. what do you normally get in the headphones when you do that, just out of curiosity?
whatever they have left over. String players are always last to get, you know, get our mixes. For me, it's not really that much of an issue. Like the instrument's right in my ear, so more often than not, I can hear what's coming out of, you know, out of my violin.
Yeah, but what do you like to follow though?
Oh, I prefer general mix, like an album mix almost, if possible. You know, just a little bit of everything with the vocals kind of not necessarily too hot, but right at the, you know, same level as maybe the drums and the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You need the rhythm, you need the harmonic instruments so that you can have stay in tune, as well as, know where to come in.
Yeah, right. So now you do most of the stuff in your studio, so you're comfortable, it's easy, you know your studio, you know how everything works, you could do it quickly. But prior to having a studio, you had to go other places. And I'm just curious, what was the worst conditions you had to record under? Because if you're an electric guitar player, it's one thing, and you can record almost anywhere and do okay. If you're a string player, it's something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, again, like a lot of the hip-hop guys used to like to just kind of bounce stuff in their own MPC and record it into whatever and bounce it down. So it's like taking a high-resolution audio file, mixing it to a 16-bit, like whatever MP3 type sound, and then putting it back into the song. If you add that to like an SM57, it's not going to sound that great. I think I've, experienced that in someone's bedroom before. That kind of thing. Yeah. With a lot of, like, especially if there's a lot of, computers and other machines whirling around.
Yeah. What's your favorite type of music to work with then?
Honestly, I like a good song. I mean, it can be anything, like R&B or hip hop or like straight pop sounds, or I like it all. I just love to play. I love to create. I love to add something,
When you work with other string players who are most likely classically trained, how do they view you?
Well, usually I'm hiring them, so they don't tell me. They wouldn't tell me that. But I think I've gained some respect, especially in like the people that do, the crossover stuff. I don't usually go out and hire like the straight legit kind of people for the most part. So I'm hiring people that might have been classically trained, but grew up listening to pop music and, and they're all, I like to think that they're all kind of like, in some ways I'm where they want to be, like having a studio, having a space to work, having, all these people that they love to work with and all this. So generally we all get along.
What I've noticed is that there's a hardcore contingent of classical players that kind of look down upon the pop end of the business. And then, there, as you say, there's a whole lot of people that are kind of outside that and can live in that world, but can really live in the pop or rock or whatever other world, the anything other than classical.
Exactly. I've been more recently producing a few different artists. One of them is this girl, Leah Zeger, who's classically trained violinist, but also plays a lot of the Django style, a lot of the swing kind of like stuff, as well as pop music. ELO went on tour a couple of years ago. They hired her as the main violinist.
Wow.
But she's also part of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, and so she does legit gigs also. But she can also sing her ass off. She was an opera trained singer. So,
wow.
Yeah, she's incredible. We should be coming out with something by March or April, I believe. Really incredible singer and violinist.
So what kind of music is it then?
It's fun jazz, I would say. Like fans of Norah Jones, fans of, Diana Krall or Esmeralda Spalding will love her.
Yeah.
She's incredibly talented, but it's also fun and tongue-in-cheek kind of songs. And
how long does it take you to record something like that? Just out of curiosity. And taking into account the caliber of players we're talking about.
Well, with her, I mean, there's not a lot of other players. Some usually will bring in a drummer, occasionally, sometimes bass, or more often than not, I'm doing the bass. Sometimes another pianist or something. A few days per song, ultimately, but it's hard because she's, like I said, she's so incredibly talented and so incredibly busy. She's very in demand. So it's, split between like maybe 2 or 3 days a month over the last year that we've been able to really get into it.
Sure. No, I understand. Okay, let's get geeky for a bit then. What is your favorite signal path? Microphone, microphone preamp. What do you think works best?
I have, for me, I use a hybrid kind of U47. It's an older Sound Deluxe 47 that was actually the prototype made out of all original parts. That's my main close mic. And it sounds great on everything from strings to vocals or in front of a guitar amp, you know, not too close, but it sounds great on everything. I've never heard it sound bad. For the room mics, sometimes, depending on the song, like if it's a softer song, I'll put up a pair of Royers 122s. I like just for the gain issue. Sometimes the Mojave, you know, Mojaves are great. I've used those for years. And then more recently, I got a Telefunken stereo. What's it? AR-71, I think they call it.
Yeah,
it sounds pretty good. And I've had a, you know, new old stock tube put in, GE tube. So that's my room mic. Those usually go through the Aurora Audio GTQ2 for the close mic. And usually with no EQ, just the using the preamp and a high pass filter. And the rooms go through a Vintec 473.
Okay, so 1073 clones, essentially, you're using.
And then the close mic, I usually put a little bit of, I use a 1176, you know, compression, just a touch. More as a limiter than a compressor, I'd say. And then into my Pro Tools, I have a HD native system.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I can see your setup.
Yeah, you can see some of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got some nice gear.
Yeah, you do.
I've got a nice little, you know, mix of different, you know, between the UA stuff, the API, Trident, you know, I can get a lot of different tones. But as far as the string work, the ones I mentioned are for me, sound the best.
You know, I find that really interesting in that your ears are finer tuned to what you're doing. And what you would choose might not be what other engineers might choose. That being said, there's nothing totally exotic that you're using. So in a way, I'm kind of surprised that it's not something that is, you know, really exotic that most people might not hear.
I had always heard from a lot of different string engineers, you know, who were doing pop music, that they would always have trouble, like, having the strings be able to cut through and getting enough of the kind of highs, mid-highs to make it work in a song, in a pop song. So, you know, I like the tube mics and the Neve clones to kind of make that happen in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Here's another geeky question for you. When you're mixing your however large section that you've recorded, mm-hmm. where do you start from?
Well, when I'm doing it for my own thing or when I'm sending it to someone else?
Either. Or both.
Well, like I said, if I'm doing a larger section, I'll mix it down to like each section plus each like individual track or individual type like section of the orchestra. So the you would end up with a close mic stereo stem of all the first violins, room mic stereo stem of all the first violins, you know, close second violins, room second. So you'd end up with 8 or more stereo stems, basically. Mm-hmm. So that the mixer, whoever's doing it in the song, and then I'll balance them the way I kind of hear them, however it is in that song, and send it off. So whoever's mixing it will have the options to, you know, oh, I like more close mic cello or more room violins, whatever it might be, you know.
The reason why I ask is, I had a mentor that did a lot of orchestral recording, and the way he taught me was when you're doing strings, when you're balancing everything up, you always go from highest to lowest, rather than kind of the opposite when you're talking about rock and roll mixing where you're going lowest to highest. You know, this is highest to lowest, and it works, but I'm curious if that's the way you would approach it.
Yes, probably, actually. Like, I'm not even thinking about it, like, I do usually start with the violins I usually, when I'm recording something, you know, I'll do the arrangement first on a keyboard and get it, you know, that way I can play it for people, you know, get the approvals and all that. But when I'm recording, I almost always start with cello. I start with a low end and work my way up. But then when I am mixing it down, when I'm going through it, I'll start with the violins and go backwards.
Yeah. Okay.
But I never really consciously thought of it in that sense. But maybe that's just the natural tendency. I don't know.
Yeah. Again, this was kind of drilled into me. You know, you start from the top down on that. Again, it seems to work.
Right.
I guess naturally, if you go that way, then it must work. Okay. Last question, Stevie. What is the best piece of advice that you received, or maybe the best piece of advice that kind of dawned on you along the way? Did somebody tell you something that was kind of like the light going on?
Oh, gosh. Like as far as the recording process or as a musician in general?
Musician, business.
As a musician, yeah. I mean, a few people told me, you know, only do it if you love it, because you never know if you're going to really, you know, make a living out of it. You know, just you have to love it. You have to, you know, really, there has to be nothing else you can do or that you feel that you want to do, you know, in order to achieve what you want to achieve, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, all musicians have gone through the struggling artist periods and, you know, thankfully I'm out of that, you know, hopefully forever, but you know, you never know, but it's still, you know, it's so ingrained in me, like second nature. Music is who I am and what I am. I couldn't do this if I wasn't fully invested in and passionate about it. And I still love it. I still love working every day and working on different people's music and the variety that I get.
Yeah.
Like I say, sometimes I'll get a call just to play mandolin, and that's fun, you know?
Yeah.
That's cool for me. Like, that type of thing. It's all fun. I love it all.
Was there a piece of business advice that someone imparted to you?
Huh. Well, I don't know if there was anything someone said, but I realized from an early age that if I wanted to do, you know, if I wanted to be serious about music, I guess actually Livingston Taylor at Berkeley told me. I was there his first year. We became buddies and we'd go off and have coffee after class and, you know, and talk. And I think he was the one that probably said, like, you know, if you're going to do this, you should know everything that goes on. You should, you know the whole business side of things as well as the music side. Because, you know, otherwise you're going to get ripped off. And a lot of people had, you know.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yeah, just learn as much about the business as you can. And I, you know, when I was in college, I used to like build stages and stadiums for rock shows, you know, and things like that. And I would do lighting for tons of different bands coming through town and learned everything that goes on backstage hours, days before the bands get there.
Yeah.
And that's where bands go, you know? Yeah. So in that sense, that was fun also just to learn, you know, what a lot of musicians have no idea that goes on with these people and to make their concerts go.
Well, Stevie, this has been great. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you for thinking of me. I really appreciate it. And, you know, I'm available for hire if anyone on listening needs some strings.
Okay, well, we'll put the word out. To find out more about Stevie, go to stevieblack.com. That's Stevie, S-T-E-V-I-E. Black is B-L-A-C-K-E. All one word, stevieblack.com. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. We love seeing your comments and seeing your questions. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.